This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Stephen King, has written a new novel. It's got a horror house and a torture chamber, but it's not exactly a horror novel. It's set in an amusement park called Joyland in 1973. The park's funhouse may be haunted by a ghost, which might explain the dead bodies, but the book isn't exactly a supernatural thriller either. The main character is a college student who aspires to write for The New Yorker. After his heart is broken by his girlfriend, he wants to get away from his life in New England and takes a job in North Carolina at the amusement park, where he enters a different world. Terry Gross spoke with Stephen King earlier this week.
Stephen King, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you back on our show. I would like you to start with a reading from Joyland. And there's probably an official word for this page. The detective books I used to buy when I was, like, in my early teens used to have this kind of page. It's like a page with a lot of, like, drama in it. I want you to read that page.
Hi, Terry. It's a pleasure. And this is the tease for Joyland. I stashed my basket of dirty rags and turtle wax by the exit door in the arcade. It was 10 past noon, but right then food wasn't what I was hungry for. I walked slowly along the track and into Horror House. I had to duck my head when I passed beneath the screaming skull, even though it was now pulled up and locked in its home position. My footfalls echoed on a wooden floor painted to look like stone. I could hear my breathing. It sounded harsh and dry. I was scared, okay? Tom had told me to stay away from this place, but Tom didn't run my life any more than Eddie Parks did. Between the dungeon and the torture chamber, the track descended and described a double S-curve where the cars picked up speed and whipped the riders back and forth. Horror House was a dark ride, but when it was in operation, this stretch was the only completely dark part. It had to be where the girl's killer had cut her throat and dumped her body. How quick he must have been, and how certain of exactly what he was going to do. I walked slowly down the double S, thinking it would not be beyond Eddie to hear me and shut off the overhead work lights as a joke, to leave me here to feel my way past the murder site with only the sound of the wind and that one slapping board to keep me company. And suppose, just suppose, a young girl's hand reached out in that darkness and took mine.
That's Stephen King reading from his new novel, Joyland. So, why did you want to write a crime novel? What do you like about that genre as a reader and as a writer?
Well, when I was a kid, my mother used to read Earl Stanley Gardner, Perry Mason mysteries, and Agatha Christie's. And I never really cared much for the courtroom drama. The Earl Stanley Gardners and the Perry Masons always seemed, even as a kid, to be a little bit stylized to me and a little bit fake. But I loved the Agatha Christie. It was all there in front of you, so that when Miss Marple got everybody together in a room and said, this and this and this should have been obvious to me, I'm thinking to myself, well, it should have been obvious to me, too. There was a puzzle element to it, and, you know, I just couldn't figure out how anybody could plot that way. And I guess the reason why was because I was never built to be the sort of writer who plots things. I usually take a situation and go from there. So with Joyland, there is a trail that you can follow that leads to the killer. But you know what? If you figured out who it was in advance, you were doing better than I was, because I got near the end of the book before I realized who it was.
Uh-oh. You might have been
in trouble. No, that's good. I think that's good.
Is it? Why?
I don't want the reader to feel like this is all a sort of prefab creation. I want it to feel organic, to feel like it grew by itself. I've never seen novels as built things. I have a tendency to see them as found things, so that I always feel a little bit like an archaeologist who's working to get some fragile fossil out of the ground. And the more you get out unbroken, the better you succeed.
So this is a crime novel that's set in an amusement park in North Carolina. But there's also an element of the supernatural in it. Why did an amusement park that's kind of very carny seem like a good opportunity to combine crime and the supernatural?
Well, I always wanted to write a novel set in an amusement park. And in the original concept of The Shining, that was going to be a family that was caretaking an amusement park at the close of the season.
And instead of an old hotel.
Instead of an old hotel, yeah. And I had a title for the book. I was going to call it Dark Shine. And ever since I was a little boy and I went to the Topsom Fair, I've loved the rides and the barkers. I think those people in particular, the shy bosses, they're called. They're the people who turn the tips. They're the ones who stand out in front and tell you, you know, everybody wins, folks. Everybody wins. Come on over. It's just a quarter of a dollar and everybody wins. Hey, mister, you want to win this big stuffy toy for your girlfriend? She's a beauty and she deserves, you know, that kind of thing. In a way, it's a little bit like revival preachers, but in a secular version. So I've always been kind of fascinated by those things and in love with it. And I just kind of wanted to visit that world for a while. I had an idea for the story, which, by the way, has been in my head for about 20 years now. And all it was, to begin with, was an image of a boy in a wheelchair flying a kite on a beach. And that picture was just as clear in my mind as it could be. And it wanted to be a story, but it wasn't a story. It was just a picture, as clear, as clear, as clear. And little by little, the story built itself around it. And I thought, well, there's an amusement park down the beach from where this kid in the wheelchair is trying to fly his kite. And the name of the amusement park is Joyland. Then I went to the internet, which is every writer's newest crutch. And I looked at amusement parks. I wanted one that was nice and clean and sunlit, but wasn't too big. So I didn't want a Disney World. I didn't want a Six Flags park. And I settled on a place called Canobie Lake, which is in Massachusetts, just about the right size. And I got a map of the place, and I printed it out. And then I started to think, well, this is going to be my fun house, and it's going to be called Horror House, and this is going to be my Ferris wheel, and it's going to be called the Carolina Spin, because it's going to be in Carolina on the beach there. And little by little, these things came together. And then, as I wrote the book, it became less and less like a standard amusement park and more like the carnies I remembered from my youth. And the more carny it got, the better I liked it, actually. And I started to go to websites that had various carny language, some of which I remembered a little bit. Pitchman called Shy Bosses, and their concessions called Shies, and the little places where they sold tickets and sometimes sat down and rested would call their dog houses. And then other stuff I just made up, like calling pretty girls points. I can't remember some of the other ones. It's all mingled together now in my head.
So you mentioned the boy in the wheelchair was the first image that came to you. And that boy in the novel is a 10-year-old named Mike who has muscular dystrophy, but a special kind, which usually kills you in your early teens or 20s. But Mike has the sight. What is the power that he has?
He has a power to see a little bit beyond this world, and he has a very small talent compared to some of the other characters in books that I've written. He's got a little bit of precognition.
When you were in your formative years, what were your supernatural fears, and did you always wish you had some of the supernatural powers that you've given some of your characters?
I think it's built in. I think it's just part of human nature. I've been queried a lot about where I get my ideas or how I got interested in this stuff. And at some point, a lot of interviewers just turn into Dr. Freud and put me on the couch and say, what was your childhood like? And I say various things and I confabulate a little bit and kind of dance around the question as best as I can. But bottom line, my childhood was pretty ordinary, except from a very early age, I wanted to be scared. I just did. I was scared. Afterwards, I wanted a light on because I was afraid that there was something in the closet. My imagination was very active, even at a young age. For instance, there was a radio program at that time called Dimension X. And my mother didn't really want me to listen to that because she felt it was too scary for me. So I would creep out of bed and go to the bedroom door and crack it open. And she loved it, so apparently I got it from her, but I would listen at the door. And then when the program was over, I'd go back to bed and quake.
So you wanted to be scared? Or, I mean, did you have an avoidance thing with being scared, or did you just want to be scared?
Terry, I loved it. It was a classic attraction-repulsion thing. I wanted to be scared. I wanted that reaction. I can self-analyze to a degree, and it might be right and it might be wrong, but here's what I really think. I wanted an emotional engagement with something that was safe, something that I could pull back from, and I had a big imagination. I wanted to put it to work, even at an early age. So I would ask my mother to take me to movies like Earth versus the Flying Saucers or Them. And she was okay with that. She was down with that because she liked it. So I think it's built in. I think it's like a piece of magnetic steel that draws a needle.
Are there things that scare you as an adult that you were not aware enough of or smart enough for when you were a kid to understand that these were frightening things?
Well, you grow up and you become frightened of different things, and they have a tendency to be real world things.
Yeah.
It's been quite a while since I was really afraid that there was a boogeyman in my closet. Although I am still very careful to keep my feet under the covers when I go to sleep, because the covers are magic, and if your feet are covered, it's like boogeyman kryptonite. So I'm not as afraid of that as I used to be. The supernatural stuff doesn't get to me anymore. But here's the movie that scared me the most in the last 12 or 13 years. The movie opens with a woman in late middle age sitting at a table and writing a story. And the story goes something like, "Then the branches creaked in the..." And she stops. And she says to her husband, "What are those things? I can't think of them. They're in the backyard and they're very tall and birds land on the branches." And he says, "Why, Iris, those are trees." And she says, "Yes, how silly of me." And she writes the word and the movie starts. That's Iris Murdoch. And she's suffering the onset of Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
That's the boogeyman in the closet now.
Why is that the thing you're most afraid of?
I'm afraid of losing my mind.
Losing your memory?
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't just lose your memory. You lose your mind. Basically,
Yeah. You
lose your identity, your sense of who you are, where you are. If you're a block away from the house, you may forget how to get home. I think I could put up with a lot of things and a lot of pain. I have put up with a lot of pain. I got hit by a car in 1999 and got most of the bones on the right side of my body broken. And I bore up under that and I got better. But you can't get better if your mind is stolen away from you. So here's what I'm saying. As we get older, our fears in some way sharpen and become more personal because we can no longer, take a book like It or maybe Christine and say, these are make-believe fears. Instead, we have more of a tendency to focus on things that we know are out there. We fear for our families. We fear for our mental abilities. We fear for diseases. You may see a dark spot on your arm or an irregular mole and say, gee, I better get that checked out. If you're a woman doing a self-breast exam and you feel a lump that wasn't there before, these are very real fears. So when you ask me what I'm afraid of, I'd say I still go to see ghost movies when I get a chance or some sort of supernatural being, that kind of thing. But it doesn't scare me as it scared me when I was a child. But on the other hand, if I see a wonderful writer like Iris Murdoch losing her mind, I have more of a tendency to focus on that than how loving her husband was, which is supposed to be the uplifting part of that film.
So, you know, you mentioned your car accident from 1999. Are you still in chronic pain as a result of that?
I guess I am, but I don't think about it very much anymore. I exercise a lot, and I try to stay as mobile as I possibly can. I can remember the doctor saying to me, well, after the accident, I asked the guy, will I ever be able to play tennis again? And he said, no, but you'll be able to walk. Well, I can play tennis again, and I think
wow, that, really?
Well, you know,
I mean, your leg was crushed, basically.
It was crushed. But I think that doctors have a tendency to lowball, so that if you get a little more than they say, you say, wow, I'm really beating the odds here. I'm doing a terrific job. But you just go ahead and you do the therapy and you bear the pain, because you're told that if you do the therapy and bear the pain, things will get better. And that actually seems to be the case.
So one time when we spoke after the accident, you were saying, you know, you had had an addiction problem with pills, and you'd kick that, you were clean, and then you're in this horrible accident, and you're on painkillers that are addictive, and much as you wanted to not take them, like after a certain kind of accident like the one you were in, you really need help. You really mm-hmm. need painkillers. So were you able to successfully get off of them?
I had the accident in 1999, and at that time, OxyContin hadn't been on the market very long, 2 years, maybe three. You could check me on that, but it wasn't a long time. And I was a mess, Terry. I mean, the muscles were just hanging off what remained of my leg, and they talked very seriously about amputating the leg and ended up doing something called a fasciotomy instead, that let out just enough of the blood and the swelling so that I could keep the leg. But it was broken everywhere. You couldn't even count the breaks. He said, the doctor that worked on me said it was like marbles in a sack. And the pain was terrible. And they said, you know, we have this wonderful drug called OxyContin, and we think that it's going to be a game changer for you. And it was. And I loved that stuff. I loved the fact that I was able to finish the book that I'd been working on called On Writing. The pain was terrible, but the pills made the pain better. They helped the physical pain, but they also cheered you up the way that addictive drugs do. So by, I would say, 2 years down the road post-accident, I was a total junkie again. I was using probably somewhere between 280 and 400 milligrams of Oxy a day. And my leg hurt as bad as it ever did, because your brain basically wants that dope and refers the pain or creates the pain so that you'll continue to get it. And finally, that just had to stop, that's all. And I kicked it. And it's not for anybody out there who's doing Oxy, who thinks you can't kick it, you absolutely can. It's a 3-week process. It's a physical process where you shiver and shake. They don't call it kicking the habit for nothing. But when it's done, it's done. And there's no residual urge to use that I ever felt. So I've been clean, totally clean for a long time now.
Do you think your writing has changed, or what you want to write about has changed?
It's, I don't
in
know.
The years
I'm on
since
the
accident, because at first you said you weren't going to write for a while, but you know, you're still writing.
Yeah, but the thing is, when I said that I wasn't going to write, or when I was going to retire, I was doing a lot of OxyContin for pain, and I was still having a lot of pain, and it's a depressive drug anyway, and I was kind of a depressed human being because the therapy was painful, the recovery was slow, and the whole thing just seemed like too much work. And I thought, well, I'll concentrate on getting better, and I probably won't want to write anymore. But as health and vitality came back, the urge to write came back. Now, here's the thing. I'm on the inside, and I am not the best person to ask if my writing changed after that accident. I don't really know the answer to that. I do know that since then, I've that was close. That was really being close to stepping out, the accident. And a couple of years later, I had double pneumonia, and that was close to stepping out of this life as well. And I think you have a couple of close brushes with death like that. It probably has... somebody said the prospect of imminent death has a wonderful clarifying effect on the mind. And I don't know if that's true, but I do think it probably causes some changes, some evolution in the way a person works. But on a day-by-day basis, I just still enjoy doing what I'm doing.
The cover of Joyland, which is your new crime novel on the Hart Case Crime Press. But first of all, I want to ask you, this is not, you're the kind of successful writer that can get a really large advance for a book. I doubt Hart Case Crime can pay you the kind of advance that you get because, I mean, they're this really little press devoted to a certain type, like a certain niche of like the hard-boiled crime novel. They love those like old-fashioned pulp covers. Your book has one of those. They do like original paperbacks and I think some like republications of paperbacks. Why did you want to write for them? It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be your biggest moneymaker because of the press.
Hard Case Crime is a throwback to the books that I loved as a kid. We lived way out in the country and my mother would go once a week shopping and she would go to the Red and White or the AMP to pick up her groceries. And I would immediately beat feet to Robert's Drugstore where they had a couple of those turnaround wire racks with the hard-boiled paperbacks that usually featured a girl in scanty clothing on the front. She'd usually, you know, be kind of dressed like a cigarette girl and there'd be a lucky strike hanging from one corner of her mouth and she'd have an automatic pistol in her hand. The teaser line that I always loved the most was for a novel called Liz where it said, "She hit the gutter and bounced lower."
So that's great.
I love that. And I, you know, the one on the front of Joyland says, "Who dares enter the funhouse of fear?"
And I want to mention there's a teaser line. There's a limited edition hardcover version of the book, although the book is largely paperback. And the teaser line on the hardcover version is, "Beyond the lights, there is only darkness." I like that.
I wrote that line.
Did you like? I like that.
Yeah, I wrote that line.
And that's the lights
what
of the amusement
park. Beyond the
that
lights
it's set
is
in.
Only darkness.
Yeah.
Read the line again.
You like it that much? You want to hear it again? Okay.
I didn't hear the end of it.
"Beyond the lights, there is only darkness."
Can I write or what? God. Just kidding.
Stephen King's new novel is called Joyland. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the French electronica duo Daft Punk. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Daft Punk is a French music act that's been releasing albums since 1997. They appear on stage in helmets that disguise their faces and have long specialized in impersonal but catchy electronic music. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says their new album, Random Access Memories, is a departure, an attempt to add a more human sound to their music.
That until this new album, I wasn't much of a Daft Punk fan. I could appreciate the craft and imagination that went into creating their mixture of electronic genres, techno, house, disco. But the mechanical repetitions and vocals run through filters didn't turn me on in any other way. But now, the French duo that comprises Daft Punk, Thomas Bangalter and Guy-Manuel de Oman Cristo, have come up with an album that exposes the human side of their musical impulses. It's the equivalent of removing the helmet masks the pair invariably wears in public performances. Random Access Memories is a collection filled with music suggesting mad romance, heartache, and an embrace of the past that is never merely nostalgic or sentimental.
Like the legend of the phoenix, all ends with beginnings. What keeps the planet spinning? The force from the beginning.
That's Get Lucky, the album's first single, a superb track featuring lead vocals from Pharrell Williams and guitar work by Nile Rodgers, the man who co-founded the great disco band Chic in the 70s. The rhythm of Get Lucky is lushly irresistible. It's a perfect example of what seems to have struck the Daft Punk boys, now in their late 30s, as a revelation. After years of constructing their music by sampling bits of other artists' beats and riffs, using technology to strip dance music down to its essence, they want to build their sound back up with a fresh humanity. They do it by largely avoiding samples on this new album, having Rodgers and others play real guitars, and inviting other non-mechanized voices to do some of the vocal work. These range from Pharrell to Paul Williams. Yes, the Paul Williams who wrote 70s hits such as The Carpenters' We've Only Just Begun. One of my favorite cuts on the album is Fragments of Time, which features a vocal by Todd Edwards and sounds a little like a vintage Steely Dan track, sleek and serenely clever.
Driving this road down to paradise, letting the sunlight into my eyes. Our only plan is to improvise, and it's crystal clear that I don't ever want it to end. If I had my way, I would never leave.
Days into Melodies goes a line in that Daft Punk composition, and it's this new desire to create songs that you and I could sing along to maintain the intensity and rhythms of dance music while letting it take a human breath, that gives Random Access Memories its touching vulnerability. Daft Punk still makes appearances in helmets, but their feelings are no longer masked. Turns out these would-be robots are romantics, but they're not old softies. This is music that uses its creator's thorough sense of pop history to create a sense of uplift, purpose, and passion.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new album Random Access Memories by the French band Daft Punk. Coming up, our critic at large John Powers talks about the movies he saw at this year's Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Cannes Film Festival, held annually on the French Riviera, is the world's most important film festival. Fresh Air's critic-at-large John Powers attended this year's festival, which wrapped up last Sunday. He spoke with Terry about the best and worst films he saw at Cannes.
John, welcome back to Fresh Air. Welcome back from France.
Hello.
So let's start with the film that won the grand prize at Cannes.
Yes, well, the Palme d'Or winner is a French film called, in French, La Vie d'Adèle, but in English it's called Blue is the Warmest Color. And it was the film of the festival, by which I mean it was the film that people loved the most, some hated the most, and everyone talked about the most. The quick version of it is that it's a film about basically centered on two young women who fall in love. And it is a lesbian love story, but of a very special kind, partly because the film is 3 hours long, partly because the centerpiece of the film at some level is the longest, most explicit sex scene I've ever seen in a film that wasn't a film designed for a porn theater, and partly because the film is very emotional, very natural in its acting. So it's an incredibly expressive movie that is also kind of exasperating, especially for English-speaking people, I think.
Well, part of it, too, is that the filmmaker is French-Tunisian. And I think this film is going to be is already very controversial in part of the Muslim world. And I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's already been condemned by Islamic extremists.
Oh, yes. No, the interesting thing is the film director's name is Abdelatif Kashish, who is perhaps the most acclaimed film director in France. He's already made two films, one called L'Esquive, the other called The Secret of the Grain, that completely swept the César Awards, which are the French equivalent of the Oscars, and were huge hits. And with this, by winning Cannes, he now is probably the most acclaimed French director, and curiously, in some ways, the most French director. That if you actually looked at the fantasies of Frenchness, of the things they like films to be about, crazy love, big emotions, natural acting, freedom of the body with nudity and all the rest, he gives them all. So he's like Tunisian-born, being condemned by Muslims, yet is somehow quintessentially French in a way that's very interesting. So you have that going on with the controversy surrounding it, plus the fact that the acting is really, really great in the film because he's one of the best directors of actors in the world. And I kept saying to people in the days after I saw the film that all the acting in the films afterwards didn't look as good as it should because he's so good at getting people behaving the way people behave that when you see the films afterwards, everybody seems kind of actory, like they're working too hard.
So do you think this very, very long sex scene in the movie is meant to be arousing for people in the audience?
I don't think it is. Interestingly, a lot of people complained that it wasn't arousing enough, which I think is that they felt that it was clinical. And I don't think it's actually clinical, but that somehow you're detached from it, so it's not trying to turn you on, which I think is actually a virtue of the way that the filmmaker did it. Because, in fact, one thing that's undeniable is that the actresses seem excited. The characters are having good sex for them. But at the same time, it's not really intended to or achieving titillation for the audience. It goes on too long, and maybe it ogles the women's bodies a little bit. But having said that, it's not some sort of cheap HBO, Showtime, ghastly sex scene of the kind that makes me want to turn off the TV. It's a completely different thing.
So, John, I am very selfishly now going to ask you about the film that played at Cannes. That's the film that I most want to see, that I'm most curious about. And it's the new Coen Brothers movie, Inside Llewyn Davis, which is set in 1961 in the Greenwich Village folk scene. What'd you think?
Oh, it was my favorite film at Cannes.
Oh, good.
I have not been a great Coen champion or detractor. I'm kind of up and down on them. I think this may be their best film. And what it is it's a, in a way, it's a very simple story. An actor named Oscar Isaac plays Llewyn Davis, who was a sort of a folk singer in the early 60s based kind of loosely on the singer Dave Van Ronk. And what he is he's a guy who sings traditional folk songs and has a beautiful voice, and somehow he's just not making it. You know, that he's struggling in his career, and then you watch him more or less go through a day or two or three as he struggles, and he travels around more or less trying to make his career go. And he has a kind of odyssey, accompanied in a huge part by a cat that he somehow finds himself stuck with. So you have a kind of selfish, grumpy, artistic folk singer caught with a cat, traveling around, trying to get his life together. And at that level, basically, that's the plot. It's, in some way, it's kind of a Shaggy Dog story. But in fact, what it's all about is about this guy who's at this moment of history, who has talent, and his perceptions are the perceptions of a person who's living in the Bob Dylan era. He actually will remind you in some of the things he says of something that Bob Dylan might have said, but he hasn't yet adjusted his music to the world that Bob Dylan will create. He's not Bob Dylan. He's a really good folk singer on the verge of a breakthrough of consciousness who isn't making the breakthrough himself. The film's also, may I add, just because maybe this makes it sound serious, it's really, really funny. That it's funny in a way that the Coen brothers often aren't funny, which is it's not snide funny. It's kind of warm, sly funny. There are no big caricatured characters. There's no nasty violence played for laughs. It's the most muted, quiet, sweet film they've ever made. I think in part because they actually love the folk songs, and there's a lot of folk singing in the film.
Are they original songs or old folk songs?
They're all. There's one new song, a hilarious kind of gimmick song that people sing in the thing, but all the rest are all old folk songs played absolutely straight. And part of the interest of the film and the achievement of it is this actor, Oscar Isaac, who people will know if they see the film, they'll know him from other things, is that he actually sings live these songs very beautifully while playing the guitar. And the music producer, T-Bone Burnett, in talking about it, said he thought this might be unprecedented in movie history, that somebody came in, learned 30 minutes of music, and then performed it live. So he's giving a really, really great performance.
Tell us about another film that was a favorite of yours at Cannes.
Oh, I think the film that didn't win anything that I really loved was a film called La Grande Bellezza, The Great Beauty. It's by a guy named Paolo Sorrentino, who has been struggling for years to make the great film that you always think he's going to make. This one is essentially his version of La Dolce Vita meets Fellini's Roma. It's set in Rome, and it's about a guy who's a writer, who's kind of, if you remember La Dolce Vita, Marcello Mastroianni played a kind of observer of the rich person scene. And this guy is the older version of that. And he essentially just looks at the rich people in Rome behaving decadently and stupidly. You see all the phony art. You see all the crazy dancing. You see all the meaningless sex. But as the movie progresses, you get this vision of the world in which there's all this craziness and selfishness. Yet if you look properly, there are all these little glimpses of beauty underneath. Part of that beauty is simply Rome. So that this is the most beautifully shot film about Rome I've ever seen. I mean, I think almost everybody I know thought, I've got to go to Rome when they watch this movie. Because somehow the filmmaker Sorrentino got them to just let him like empty out entire streets so that the hero can walk at night, and it's just ravishingly beautiful. But what the film is about finding the beauty in the ridiculous and the absurd. And it's really very moving. It starts off so aggressive because it's loud music and Italian people going crazy, and ends quiet and soft and beautiful. I mean, it was my favorite thing. I don't know why it didn't win anything, but, you know, things you like don't always win. That's the story of the world.
Hmm. Usually at Cannes, there's at least one film that gets a lot of boos. People are very... are not reluctant to let their emotions be known. So what got the most boos this year at Cannes?
Oh, this year's boo winner was a film called Only God Forgives by Nicholas Winding Refn. He's a Danish director who makes tough guy, stylized, more or less action movies for art house audiences. His last film was a film called Drive with Ryan Gosling. In this one, he's made a film set in Thailand where Ryan Gosling plays a mama's boy who runs a kickfighting academy and gets involved in a plot with murder and all the rest. This was the film that I guess what I would call the fanboys of Cannes, and there are a lot of them, the ones who just really love cool action movies, were dying to see. It was the film that people came the earliest to see. It was the hardest ticket to get in. And the movie started, and they were so revved up. You could actually feel the palpable excitement of the nerdy guys in the room. And then gradually you could feel the air sink out as somehow it wasn't the movie they wanted it to be. And, you know, they felt it was a disaster in part because the guy they think of as the hero, the Ryan Gosling figure, turns out to not be the fantasy figure they want in a movie. He can't fight. He's a mama's boy with an overbearing mother played by Kristin Scott Thomas. But he's a mama's boy who can't deal with his mom. In order to escape her, somebody else has to kill her for him. So this is like almost the nightmare of a fantasy for someone who goes in loving the tough guy fantasy of tough guy drivers and tough guy outlaws. The hero here is a guy who can't do any of this stuff and needs a real man to do it for him, which is like the most paranoid nightmare, I think, of the kind of fanboy who loves Refn's work.
You're making it sound interesting.
Well, it's only 90 minutes. So, you know, I mean, I thought it was kind of interesting because I felt as though Refn was unconsciously making a movie about his fan base, which is something you don't see very often. The audience that loves him tried to say they liked it, but they thought they didn't like it really. And the rest of the world never liked this guy's films anyway. So they gleefully booed. And it must be said that at Cannes, people don't just boo, they like booing. You know, it's a great release, partly because, you know, in this case, people stood outside at 7:30 in the morning to see the film. So when it wasn't good, they were ready to boo. And boy, did they.
So, best actor and best actress. Best actor went to Bruce Dern, who's in Alexander Payne's new film. And best actress went to the woman who was the lead in...
Berenice Bejo.
Yes, I don't know how to pronounce it. She was the lead in the French film The Artist, which won all the awards at the Oscars, what, 2 or 3 years ago. So, thoughts about their wins?
Well, I think, you know, Bruce Dern is very, very good in the Alexander Payne movie. He plays an old guy who has gotten one of those publisher's clearinghouse things and thinks he's won $1 million and is going off to claim it in Lincoln, Nebraska, accompanied by his son, played by Will Forte from Saturday Night Live. And he more or less plays a kind of crabbed, difficult guy who's a cussed figure. In fact, I don't think he was the best actor in the festival. I think Michael Douglas did a better job in Behind the Candelabra, which just showed on HBO. But Bruce Dern is really, really good. It was actually a good festival for him because when they showed The Great Gatsby on opening night, you got to see that Joel Edgerton's performance as Tom Buchanan wasn't as good as Bruce Dern's in the earlier film version. So Bruce Dern not only won Best Actor, he got to be the best Tom Buchanan in Great Gatsby at Cannes. So, hey, the best actress went to Berenice Bejo, who everyone remembers from The Artist. She was in a film, the new film by the guy who made A Separation. And it's a kind of, once again, a domestic family mystery. She's very, very good in the film, but she's not as good as Adele Exarchopoulos and Lea Seydoux, who are the two stars of the film that won Blue is the Warmest Color. Their performances were off the charts great. Whereas she's merely really good.
Well, Cannes isn't just about movies, it's about parties. What's the best party you went to?
Oh, my favorite party was a party for the AIDS research organization, AMFAR. And every year they hold a sumptuous party somewhere. This year it was at the Hotel Cap d'Antibes. And you turn up where hundreds of people are dressed in black tie, including me. I was very James Bond, I must tell everyone. And
No, you weren't.
Okay. Yes. Okay. I was a short James Bond. Can we go that far? Yes. And you turn up, and two things happen. There's entertainment, and there's an auction of various things. The entertainment on the night was you got to hear Shirley Bassey sing Goldfinger. So she came out and belted out Goldfinger and did it better than she did at the Oscars.
That's why you felt James Bondish.
I think that is why I feel. I think that probably is the connection. You know, and she was really, really good, and it was fun to hear her. You know, you also got to see one of the rare appearances by Duran Duran singing Hungry Like the Wolf. I mean, and really, it's, you know, in terms of The Great Gatsby, with those crazy parties, I mean, at some level, you haven't lived until you've been in this huge building filled with black tie rich people leaping from their dinner table to boogie to Hungry Like the Wolf. It's out of this world. But the amazing thing is not that. It's the actual auction, where they auction off for €1.5 million in this case the right to attend all the Oscar parties, including the behind-the-scenes Oscar parties on Oscar night. That went for €1.5 million. My favorite and the best, of course, was the bidding for the right to sit next to Leonardo DiCaprio as you got blasted into outer space on Virgin Galactic Airlines. That went for €1.5 million, which is basically $2 million. So you have that going on. You have rich people swirling. I got to step on the back of Paris Hilton's dress, even though I didn't want to. I got bumped into it. And, you know, you got to see also lots of beautiful people. There were lots of famous stars there. Leonardo DiCaprio was there. Nicole Kidman was there. I hadn't seen Goldie Hawn in a long time. There was Goldie Hawn. You know, as I say, Shirley Bassey, who I think looked younger than some of the members of Duran Duran. And she must be, you know, 100, whereas the Duran Duran guys looked a bit like they'd lived the rock star life. So at 50, they were in worse shape than Shirley was.
Is Leonardo DiCaprio planning on going into outer space?
Yes, he is. I think, you know, I think it's not deep outer space. I mean, I think it's one of these things where you get out of the stratosphere and then just come back down. So it's more like a shuttle flight. But yes, he is. No, I mean, I think he'd already bought his ticket. And the question was, who would get the ticket next to him? So, he's a great supporter of AMFAR, and so he was a good sport the entire night. All the stars are actually very, very happy to be there, and it's an exciting thing. I mean, it's real spectacular La Dolce Vita stuff.
Some of the films that you've mentioned will probably get a lot of attention when they open in America. Would you just tell us briefly about a film you think we should see that won't have all that ballyhoo when it opens?
There's a lovely little film called The Lunchbox. It's an Indian film, which is set in Mumbai. And it basically involves the way they use lunchboxes in Mumbai, which is that people send them to the office from their home. This one has to do when a lunchbox gets sent to the wrong person. The guy who gets it sends it back to the person with a note. And gradually they develop a relationship between a lonely business guy and a lonely wife. It sounds simple, but it's nicely turned, beautifully acted, and very moving. It has a really, really great performance by Irfan Khan, the great Indian actor who people will remember as the older guy in The Life of Pi. It's a very, very good film, very touching. I think people are really going to like it.
Well, John, thank you for telling us about Khan. It's always great to talk with you.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and is the film and TV critic for Vogue. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.